that day I live in a dream.
Welcome to Only Trying to Help, the podcast where we try to help you be helpful to other people. And I'm excited to have, I was thinking about this today, you're my third Swedish person on the show. Hey. So Fredrik, could you introduce yourself to us, please?
Mm-hmm. Sure. My name is Fredrik Eliasson, and I'm a social worker. That's for the past, 20 years or something like that, has worked in different leadership positions in government organizations such as corrections, substance use disorder, youth care, and stuff like that. And nowadays, I run my own consultancy company called Cultivate Kindness. And so that's sort of my full-time work these days, where I come in to companies or organizations and help them with transformational leadership, training in for healthcare professionals, social workers, around having like meaningful conversations with clients or patients.
Congratulations on taking that step. I knew that you had done that you're, you know, working for yourself now, and it's a really big deal. I'm really happy for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I think of you as a leadership expert. I almost said guru, and someone corrected me recently and said we ought not use the term guru. So I'm gonna refrain from that. But I'll go ahead and call you a leadership expert if that doesn't make you too uncomfortable.
It makes me a little bit uncomfortable, but thanks. It's very nice of you to say it like that.
And when I think about how you might be helpful to our audience, I think about the ways that in organizations, we get sometimes mixed messages about what it means to be helpful, what it means to do your job correctly, what it means to be a good team player. And that's a lot for people to manage. And you know what? I think, you tell me if you know the research to say this, but I think it probably contributes to a lot of people leaving their positions. You're nodding. Yeah. What can you say about some of that?
Well, I mean, some of the things that I think is helpful thinking about organizational change is from a person called Everett Rogers, who has this like bell curve on the diffusion of innovation, where he describes that in a general population, when we're thinking about change, and I think this goes for organization or workplaces as well, they're usually a small percentage, about 2.5%, it says, that the innovator, that's like the those who come up with things, new ways of working. And innovators are sometimes not actually employed in the organization. They're like the influencers, the one we read books that they authored and stuff like that. And then you have like another like couple of 4 or 5%, that's the early adopters. And those we usually meet within organizations. And they're like early on the ball. They're like searching out the new things. They want to stay close to research. They are usually quite well thought of persons within the organizations which they're working as someone who is driving change and sort of development of organizations. And then there's the early majority, and that's about like he said 35% or something like that. And there's the late majority, which is equally the same, like 35%. And at the end, there's the laggards, those who, you know, I like to do things the way I like to do things. And usually, when you as a sort of consultant or a trainer or a healthcare trainer or something like that, you meet the early adopters, those who are keen on the new sort of stuff. But when they go back into the organization and meet, you know, we do things as we always have done, and we think this is working just fine. And when you come with all your bright ideas, it just makes me feel uncomfortable, because that means that I've been doing things wrong for God knows how many years, and that is threatening to me. So I will push back on all of those new ideas. And I think that is something a lot of people can recognize.
So many, you know, past experiences are popping up in my head. And so, yeah, I think the people listening will be nodding along just like I was, thinking, And I wonder, you know, the terminology is interesting, you know, early adopters, laggers. Yeah, I wonder how much awareness people have about what group they're in. Like, is anyone sitting out there thinking, yep, I'm a lagger?
Probably not. Probably not. But I think you can recognize, and I can recognize that in myself as well, when I've been in somewhere for quite some time and something, and I've been doing something, and I think this is really good, it's really helpful, it's maybe a little bit part of my identity. And someone comes along and says, hey, there's some new stuff that seems really good. My, you know, initial reaction for myself, knowing all this, might still be, ah, that's just the new thing, isn't it? I got the really good stuff. Because I can feel, and not at the moment when it happens, it's not that conscious. It takes a bit of sort of self-reflection, but I can feel a bit threatened about that. So now my stuff, all the things that I know, is not important anymore. So I think we have, I mean, we can be early adopters and laggards, each and every one of us, depending on what type of change we're talking about.
And I've seen leaders of organizations try and get people excited about big changes with some silly methods, like let's have a pizza party.
Yes, yes. Well, there seems to be, and we can go into that a little bit if we want to, there seems to be quite concrete stuff leaders can do to develop or change organizational culture. In Swedish, I don't know if that translates to English, but in Swedish we have a saying that some things are in the wall. Do you say it like that in English as well?
I feel like I know what you mean. It's like you can just sense it in the air. We would usually say it's in the air.
Yeah. It's like the things that you breathe. It's there. It doesn't need any explanation. It's just the way we do things around here. And that might be one way of trying to describe what an organizational culture is. The way we do things here, the stuff that is learned for the new employee when they come in, like what are our shared experience and how we do problem solving and manage the work that we do in a good and efficient way, is sort of the culture of the place. And when we try to develop new ways of working that might be more aligned with the latest research or something like that, it might be in conflict with the culture that is already in existence in an organization or a workplace. And that might make the implementation of the new way of working substantially more difficult.
Like, there could be some big new initiative in an organization, but if it conflicts with the very air they breathe, you know, the assumptions around every corner, then really, as you said a few moments ago, probably any one of us could become a quote unquote lagger, and hesitant to embrace change when it's conflicting with everything we've known to be normal in the workplace.
So just to sort of give you an example, I started working in sort of helping professionals in late 1990. I was around 20 years old. I got my first job as a warden in a prison. Just like, a summer work as a prison officer in a prison. And this was an old prison. The building was built around, the 1800s. It looked very much like an old-fashioned prison, original heavy oak prison doors with long corridors. You can picture it in your head. And the attitude you were supposed to have to the inmates was, don't talk too much with them, don't socialize too much, put up a stern face. And initially, the staff that was there, that was the ordinary staff, they didn't talk to you. They gave you orders. It's your time to take the trash out, orders like that. But they didn't say, hi, good morning, how was your week? Nothing of that. And I was perplexed. I'd never been to a workplace where they didn't talk to you. They just sat there, and if they didn't have any orders to give, they just said nothing. And a few weeks went by, and at the ward where I was working, two of the inmates started to fight. And I was supposed to, I grabbed an arm, my colleague grabbed another arm, someone pushed the alarm button, more people came, we separated the inmates, and it was all handled okay. And that was like a turn of a switch. Hello, Frederick. Good morning. How was your weekend? So, and then I realized, aha, so at this workplace, what gets you to be a colleague is that you can handle yourself in a fight.
Wow.
Nobody said that. It's
No.
not like that was in the interview for getting this job, but the whole atmosphere around your person changed once you had sort of proven yourself worthy of being a colleague. And one way of trying to describe what workplace culture is what kind of actions will give you high status along your working peers. That's one way of trying to detect, because if you are in an organization, you work in an organization, it could be very hard to sort of figure out what our culture. But that's one way of trying to find it. What type of behaviors will give you high status among your colleagues?
In a way, like a simple question. It's one short question that I agree could really get at the heart of a lot of things. I imagine in some organizations, people might say, well, we get status here by being compliant and saying yes to everything and giving up all of our personal lives. And in some other organization, it might be, well, status here is being innovative and having great ideas. I don't know that I've ever
Precisely.
worked. I've never worked at one of those
No,
organizations.
me neither. Me neither.
I imagine that they're out there. Maybe they're out there. So that's really interesting.
So I think when you want to bring in new practices, more helpful practices, we sometimes talk about evidence-based practices, or research tells us that one type of helpful behaviors are more helpful than other behaviors that we might think is helpful, but research show might not actually be that helpful. So we have this idea that we need to change something in the way that we work. And if that is in conflict with the organizational culture, something's got to go. And usually, if you're not, and as leader of that organization, if you're not very persistent and methodologically working with changing the workplace culture, it's usually the culture that wins.
So if I'm a leader listening to this, I suppose I would take away from this, you can't fight the culture, but there may be some ways to slowly shift it or change it rather than trying to smash it or, change it overnight.
For sure. And this is like, and must really say, this is not my sort of area of expertise. I mean, there's a whole world out there of good researchers who've done work around this. But there's a few takeaways from that I have found in my own work as a manager or a leader that I thought were really helpful. And sort of the first step would be the new initiative that we want to influence the way that we work. Can we be very precise, or as precise as we can be, what type of behaviors we want to see more of? Is there any behaviors that we might do today that conflict with the new initiative? So really try to be as specific as possible around what type of behavior is in line with the new way of working, and what that we want to see more of, and what type of behaviors are more in line with the existing workplace culture that we might want to see less of. So that would be like the first step. And from there, research suggests that as the more consistent the leadership is about expressing clear expectations to staff, here's the list. This is what we want to see more of, and this is what we want to see less of, and here is why we think that is important. That might be like an important step to take.
It seems to me that would build trust. That, like, I can see very clearly this is what my organization expects from me. And so, if I do these things, I have some trust that this will pan out well for me.
And there needs to, in order to be efficient in this, there needs to be notice from leadership. When I do well, I must feel that I am rewarded. And if I don't, in some ways, comply, or it's not possible, I might not have the skill set at this point to do what they want me to do. It must be noticed. Something must happen. One way of trying to describe it is that we look very closely at our managers to see when we are rewarded and when we can do stuff and nothing happens. And we take that as, so this time seems to be okay. So there needs to be some sort of follow-up. If I constantly do the things that we're not supposed to do anymore, there needs to be some sort of follow-up.
What we talk about on the show are the well-meaning things people do that really aren't very helpful. And I think what you're saying is maybe it's well-meaning to just say, oh, John is not doing the right thing, but I'm just going to ignore it. I'm not going to bring it up. I don't want to bother him. I don't want to put him down or make him feel sad. And maybe out of the goodness of my heart, I as a leader might say, I won't say anything. But Frederick, what you're telling us is it's more helpful if people get clarity about what is expected and what is not expected. And when we just stay quiet about things, it's not actually as helpful as we might think that it is.
That's precisely it. I think Brené Brown, a pretty well-known American influencer and researcher around a lot of things, but leadership is one of them. She says it like this: clear is kind, unclear is unkind. And I think there's a lot of wisdom to that.
There is. That might be a nice takeaway that folks can easily remember. Clear is kind. Clear is kind. Thank you for that.
So, in order again to sort of work with the culture, first step, the list of what to do more of and what to do less of. Step number two, expressing clear expectations to the staff. This is what we want, and this is why we want it. Next step is, not surprisingly, offer sufficient support to staff. So this is the expectations. This is where the train is going. If you want your train to go anywhere else, that's not going to work. But if you want to be on this journey with us, I'm going to do everything in my power to see you succeed. So you need to offer sufficient support to be able to reach those expectations of starting to work in maybe a different manner than before.
It's really two messages in there, which is you get to decide if you're with us,
Yes.
and if you are with us, then I'm with you.
Yep. And the final step is that when you do the things that the organization wants for you, you work according to like the latest research, the best available knowledge about how you can be helpful in that situation where you are, it needs to be rewarded with I mean, I don't mean, just mean money, even though money is not important for most of us, but it's being seen. It's being seen that you do the stuff that we wanted you to do, that I think really, really is important. So having those like more difficult conversations for those who really don't really reach the targets that you want, I would say yes, you need to do that, but what you really need to do is to every day give credit and see the struggles and the effort people to give to do things a little bit differently. That's what's really the driving force of change, is the constant reinforcement of those behavior that you want people to see more of.
I suppose there may be some leaders out there who say, well, I have a few people on my team who never do anything right. And I look, I'm not in all places and I don't know all people, but I have a hard time believing that there are employees out there who are so wrong so often, that you can't find the good in what they're doing. And I would even suspect, and I guess I can't prove this, but it's just a guess. I would guess that if your eyes are really open, most people are doing more good than causing harm or making mistakes.
For sure.
And if you're struggling to see that, okay, maybe it's possible that the staff person is just that awful. Maybe that's possible. But I really believe that if you're struggling to see all that good, it might be that you're not looking closely enough.
Closely enough. Yeah, for sure, for sure. Now, I think, and I would guess most leaders would have a similar experience, that for the vast majority of a sort of a standardized population or a workforce, that would be absolutely true. But yes, there are exceptions. And that's not because people are bad or doesn't want things. Sometimes people just have a different idea about how the work is done best, and not thinking that all this new stuff is the best way to go about things. And it's not because they are bad people. It's just they have the same goal to be helpful, but the way they think that should be done might be in conflict with what you're trying to change in the service that you get.
Yeah, I think that's really well said, that very often we do have the same goal.
And there's a famous quote. I don't know who said this, but I think it's a good saying. The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Couldn't. Who did say that? I hear it all the time. I don't know who said that. We'll
I
have
don't
to
know
look
either. Yeah,
it up.
for sure. But I think that's very helpful to remember that good intention is not saying that the deed will be good. So you can't and sort of the other side of that is to recognize that people have good intentions, but still they might need to have those difficult conversation about we are going in this direction and you seem to be wanting to go in another direction. And then I'm wondering if this is the best place for you.
I think you're bringing us to, like a nice big picture look at this. I mean, every episode of this podcast is about those well-meaning things that people do when they're trying to be helpful. This is our 11th season of focusing on people who have good intentions. And I came into this conversation with you, Frederick, thinking we would be talking about leaders who have good intentions, and we did. But you're also raising how the folks who are not necessarily in a leadership role also have good intentions. And I'm glad that we came back to that because I wasn't expecting that, but I think that's a really important point that in organizations, when there's conflict, it may be conflict between two people who both have very good intentions.
For sure, for sure. And that would be the most common scenario. I thought I might just share a short story with you to illustrate sort of what happens when there is that conflict between sort of the new way of working and the old way of working. And this story, the setting is a treatment facility for boys in the age 12 to 18. They have been sentenced by a court to treatment due to, criminal behavior or substance use disorder. So this is a sort of a locked unit for, quite young people. And I used to supervise the staff by spending time on the ward and sort of observing and noticing the interaction between staff and the kids and, offer a bit of feedback and stuff like that. So when I did that, there was one boy who lived there. It was about, I think it was, who asked me, who are you and why are you here? And I told him that I work with motivational interviewing, which is like a person-centered approach with a lot of, listening skills, collaborating skills, honoring autonomy, stuff like that. The boy replied to me by saying, MI, you say, that's the sort of acronym for motivation interviewing. MI, you'd say, I like MI. I have a scheduled MI conversation once a week, but that's all an act by the staff. They must have been on some training or whatever. And I got curious and asked the boy why he thought the staff was putting on an act when they were doing MI. And the kid replied, don't get me wrong. I really like my MI conversation. When we're sitting there, it's very much about me, what I find important in life, what I need to do to reach my goals. And funny enough, he said and smiled to me, I do most of the talking. But all of the other time in this place, the staff just yells on me and tell me what to do. So this MI thing, nah, that's just an act they put on.
Ah, so it was a mismatch, Oh, wow.
That sort of really puts the finger on the two sort of competing cultures of how to work with this kid. So once a week, he met someone who was trained in MI and sort of, okay, so now I'm going to have an MI conversation, putting on my MI hat, if you will. And it was a conversation he very much liked. But then as soon as he stepped out of that room and into the ward, it was, you should know better. Why haven't you done this? You should have thought of that. Are you stupid? Why didn't you think of that before? Here's what you should do. Da, 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 da. And he said, that just makes you feel like you're miserable all the time.
That I think people can relate to no matter what role they're coming from. I mean, even if you're listening right now and you're a parent who's been trying to help your teenager at home, are you having dinner table conversations where you're following all the quote unquote rules and saying the right things? And then as soon as dinner's over, you're yelling at your child to like go clean your room. If you're doing that, then I mean, I see your good intentions with your polite and controlled dinner table conversation, but your child is seeing through it because it doesn't match the culture at home.
That's such a good way of putting it. Yeah, for sure. And maybe I might also share with you sort of the inner turmoil of having worked a long time in an organization that has changed. And this comes from a manager in a different institution, but the same setting. And I was there working with the management team around organizational culture, and this is what the research says. And this is an institution that has been very successful during, 3 to 5 years, changing their culture. And I was there sort of, this is the latest research and blah blah blah. And as a finishing, everybody, what's your takeaways from today? That kind of ending. And one of the managers said, Frederick, this feels really, really good. It feels like we're on the right path and we're taking really important steps. And I feel proud of where we're at today. And I was like, oh yes, this is exactly what I wanted to hear. But then she looked really, really sad and looked down at the table. And I noticed that and asked her, you look quite sad when you've said that. And she looked up almost with tears in her eyes, saying, but I also feel ashamed. Why do you feel ashamed? I've been working here 18 years. This is the last 3 to 5 years we've been working with sort of the new approach. All the other years, we did quite the opposite of what we're trying to implement today. And does that mean that I was doing harm for so long? It's not that easy. Facing it takes quite a bit of courage for leaders and staff to look at the way that they are currently working and be having sort of the courage to face up to, we might need to do a bit of changes around here.
Yeah, and you see me just kind of like breathing and shaking my head because yes, we're hoping that people will be courageous enough to change the way they interact with the world or change the way they offer help to people. And I worry that they may not have the courage, that it may feel safer to just keep doing what I've been doing. And then think about all the time that we lose that we could have been implementing something better.
For sure, for sure. So again, sort of what it for me at least comes back to is having brave leaders who can be that support, giving direction, giving good opportunities to learn, being clear where we're heading and why, doing thorough sort of follow-up and reinforcements when people have the courage to try to do things a little bit different than they're used to.
Thank you for this. I'm thinking about folks who may be listening and interested in more information. Do you have, like, whether it's a website you might recommend people go to, or a book you might recommend folks read, anything like that you want to share?
So I got some favorites. Well, there's of course all of the MI motivational interviewing stuff. So there's a new textbook, like fourth edition of the authoritative text on MI, which is absolutely marvelous. So that's a good read for anybody who is in sort of helping professions. And if you're interested in more about sort of the leadership stuff, there's a nice book about how MI can be helpful for leaders that Colleen Marshall and Anette Søgaard Nielsen, who is Danish, which is right next to me, have written, which is a fantastic read. And if you're interested in organizational culture, but that's more of a bite to take on actually, but there's like the authoritative text on that is by Edgar Schein. He died just a couple of years ago, but he's still seen as the sort of authoritative voice on organizational culture. And he's like textbook, if you Google him, you go right to it. I think it's in its like fifth or sixth edition, and it's from 2020 or something like that. Which is an it's a nice read, but I mean you can look up him on Wikipedia for a smaller bite-sized version of what I've been talking about.
Great, great. I feel so lucky to know you because, look, I don't know much about the correctional or prison system in Sweden, but I know a little bit about it here in the United States. And to think that you went from that kind of work to running a company called Cultivating Kindness is just amazing. Also, what I love about you is when you were in Philadelphia, where I live. And I know that you took a tour of the Eastern State Penitentiary here.
For sure, yeah.
And when you told me that you did, I was like, of course you did. But yeah, I'm fascinated by the journey of your work. And so thanks for being willing to share it with us.
Yeah, for sure. It's a pleasure. You know, it's lovely to have someone who thinks what you're saying is interesting. So I'm just glad and humbled to be able to be here with you.
Since that day, I live in a dream.